What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Beethoven, you know, he looked at a piano and it just made sense. He could just play.
So what are you saying? You play the piano?
No, not a lick. I mean, I look at a piano, I see a bunch of keys, three pedals, and a box of wood. But Beethoven, Mozart, they saw it, they could just play.
So when you look at Iron Man 3, Josh, what do you see?
Robert Downey Jr.
My boy's wicked smart. Coming up, we'll review the latest installment in the Iron Man franchise, and, inspired by the brilliant mind of Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark, we'll share our top five movie geniuses. That and more.
You like apples?
Ahead on Film Spotting. Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM5. We're also brought to you by Squarespace.com, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
And we love featuring listener testimonials here in this segment. We have one this week from our good friend Tyler James Green. He's our production manager who handles our big events, our Film Spotting live shows, and he hosts a podcast called Fuse Chicago. Tyler says, I interviewed Stephen Cohn, who is the Chicago director responsible for The Wise Kids and his upcoming Black Box, among others. And Tyler says, as a Chicago-based podcast that's interested in all kinds of art and the discussion of it, I think Film Spotting listeners will dig what we were doing, especially with this episode. And he really loves Squarespace. He says it makes getting your podcast out in the world fairly simple. With one low monthly fee, all you have to do is upload it as an audio file, fill in some boxes, submit to iTunes, and boom. You've got yourself a podcast feed. They really do make web design a stress-free process, especially for folks who want to focus on their content and not be up all night fixing bugs on their site. And that site, if you want to check out Tyler's podcast, is FuseChicago.org.
Squarespace is also offering something new, Squarespace Commerce, which provides a powerful and flexible e-commerce solution. It's integrated to work with every Squarespace template, allowing sales for both physical and digital goods. So, for example, you could sell music CDs or MP3s, hardcover books, even ebooks. There's a fast merchant account setup so you can accept payments right away, and a single interface for order management. That means tracking orders, providing customer email updates, printing shipping labels, and adding coupons. For a free trial for Squarespace, go to squarespace.com/film. Sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just give it a try. Start building your own website. If you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM5, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That includes monthly and annual plans. That's squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM5.
I'm Tony Stark. I build neat stuff. I got a great girl. And occasionally, save the world. So why can't I sleep?
You elected me on a single platform. I will defend this country at all costs. The Mandarin must be stopped.
You don't know who I am. You'll never see me coming.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. When I was enjoying the films that made Iron Man 3 director and co-writer Shane Black a very handsomely paid Hollywood screenwriting commodity, films like Lethal Weapon and The Last Boy Scout, the name Shane Black meant nothing to me. I was just a young teen enjoying action flicks with characters exchanging lines of dialogue that our friend and critic Scott Tobias described as, quote, clever and smug, cantankerous yet playful, and born of a word nerd's love of language and impulse to pick apart the cliches he's ostensibly manufacturing. That's from Scott's new cult canon entry for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the 2005 film that marked Black's first effort as a director and his first movie project of any kind since writing 1996's The Long Kiss Goodnight, for which he accepted a $4 million paycheck and then basically disappeared after it bombed. Kiss Kiss, of course, also marked a comeback of sorts for Robert Downey Jr., an actor considered by some to be among the best of his generation, who would nevertheless become better known for the bad choices he made off-screen rather than the interesting choices he made on it. Despite not breaking through to a mainstream audience, the Black-Downey collaboration worked. Not surprising, really. After all, what better way to describe Robert Downey Jr. and in turn Tony Stark than clever and smug, cantankerous yet playful? Even the bit about picking apart the cliches he's ostensibly manufacturing is appropriate, since Downey Jr. is the rare enigmatic actor who seems to have no trouble getting lost in a character while always projecting a sense of self-awareness. Picking up the pieces after the triumphant but traumatic conclusion to last summer's Avengers, the Tony Stark of Iron Man 3 is suffering from an overload of self-awareness. He can't sleep, can't stop worrying about protecting the woman he's finally settled down with, and can't stop tinkering with his multitude of Iron Men. Stark suffered an identity crisis in the first Iron Man, but he's in full-on nervous breakdown mode here, which doesn't put him in the best position to do battle with a new and formidable threat to U.S. security, the Mandarin, played by Ben Kingsley. Josh, I want to ask you, if Shane Black stepping in for Jon Favreau successfully re-energized the Iron Man franchise following the money-making but disappointing Iron Man 2. Except it turns out, I can't ask you that because you're the only person I know who actually liked Iron Man 2. Instead, I'll have to ask you if the Shane Black touch gave Iron Man a fresh coat of paint, or is this one of the prototypes that's got some impressive new gadgets but needed some more tinkering?
I don't even know if it has that many impressive new gadgets, actually. I mean, we get that lineup in the finale of about 12 or 13 different Iron Men who can pilot themselves.
And I am thinking gadgets metaphorically, figuratively, they're not literally.
I know, but still, there's no freshness here. Can I just say that?
Okay.
I mean, even though we have a new director, and you may be a little bit higher on Shane Black than I am, I wasn't quite as enthralled with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang as you and Scott seem to be. This just, it felt like a shrug. It felt not only like a third film, but a third film that wasn't really that invigorated with doing anything new with the character. It gives him this breakdown you mentioned, but it's strictly because they seem to feel, well, we need something to happen to him now. It's the third film. The movie's not really interested in the breakdown. I mean, at some points it's used as a joke. At some points it's supposed to be intensely serious. Robert Downey Jr. himself is making fun of it at other times, so It has no real weight. I'm glad he's making fun of it. I mean, that's been the real strength of this franchise, is Robert Downey Jr.'s wit. So I'm not saying that they should get rid of that at all. But other than that, there's very little here. I can't even think of a really great action sequence that it gives
really?
Us. The mid-air one, the rescue from Air Force One,
pretty good,
was probably the highlight. But were you shocked at the amount of time Tony Stark spends outside of his Iron Man costume?
That didn't bother me.
Well, it wouldn't bother me if he was in the boardroom or trading barbs with Pepper or something like that. But we get an extended action scene with him outside of Iron Man.
I actually really like that.
When he sneaks in on the crime lord's lair with his little homemade gadgets and stuff?
That didn't bother me. But there was actually an earlier sequence where we see him outside of his suit. And I thought that raised the stakes of that scene because you knew that there wasn't necessarily anything coming to the rescue. He had to get out of that himself. I like that sequence. This is one of the sequences that takes place in Tennessee.
Yeah, I can see that little part where it shows his weakness, but I don't know. Overall, this thing took forever to get going as well. You don't see much of Stark in or out of his Iron Man suit. We get all sorts of Happy Hogan. I didn't know that Jon Favreau had quit being director so that he could up his supporting role as Happy Hogan. None of that really worked for
me.
No,
it doesn't.
It just, it felt like a third sequel that no one was all that interested in really making.
Hmm. I hear what you're saying, and you're not completely wrong, but I'm going to say you're mostly wrong. I had issues with this film, some major ones and lots of little ones, and we'll get to the major ones as we get through the discussion for sure, but I guess I just had a lot more fun with this movie than you did, and I think that basically I can sum up what works and what doesn't work by going back to what you just said. I think what doesn't work is, by the end of the film, it absolutely feels like a third movie. It feels like yet another big Hollywood blockbuster that just has to keep upping the ante and having more explosions and more chaos. But at the same time, I think that Shane Black's voice here, particularly with the screenplay and what they do to Tony's character in terms of stripping him down a little bit, I think that is the new element here that you wouldn't necessarily expect with a third movie. So that really worked for me. And I guess I can sum it up this way. This is a movie that literally passed the 10:30 test, which has happened a few times over the years here on Film Spotting, where the only time I can go see a film, it turns out, is at 10:30 at night or really late at night. And in this case, I'd had a lot to eat, had a couple pints of Guinness. I was really in no condition to go sit through a 2 hour and, what, 6 minute movie? This is on the longish side.
Yep.
So the deck is stacked against Shane Black and Robert Downey Jr. from the start. And what can I say? It kept me entertained.
It kept you awake. It sounds like you're saying it kept you awake.
It kept me awake.
So you like it?
It was entertaining.
A lot of loud noises coming from the screen could keep you awake.
Yeah, they could. But actually, loud noises would just make me want to leave the theater, Josh. And plenty of bad movies have done that to me. Rather than keep me awake, they actually make me more drowsy. In this case, I was entertained by the film. And that's ultimately all this film aspires to do. It's definitely not as good as the first Iron Man, but it's a far sight better than the second Iron Man.
Entertaining is an interesting word because that's what I would say about the second Iron Man. I did find that amusing. Mickey Rourke, though, it marked a point in his career where he was taking these roles that weren't going to capitalize on what we saw in The Wrestler just because he was back in the news. That was kind of silly. It also had Scarlett Johansson making her Marvel's Universe appearance.
Great.
But all of that sort of goofiness worked for me in that it was a fun superhero action film. It was nowhere near as good as the first one is, and I think it's worth looking back at the first one to see where some missed opportunities were in this third one, especially because we do get a new voice in Shane Black. The first film was very interesting in using Stark as a parallel for American foreign policy, really, where we feel like we can single-handedly save the world through our weaponry. And it kind of undermined that a little bit. I thought that was interesting. I don't think that's what they were entirely going for, but there were definitely some parallels.
When I think political, I think Jon Favreau.
See, I don't think that was his first thing on his mind, but it's there, and it made the movie interesting for me. Iron Man 3 had a couple of things I thought it was going to get into that could have elevated it that way. One is this whole idea of drones that we're hearing all the time. Iron Man is very much a parallel for drones, the weaponry here and how it's used. And I think if they had pushed that a little bit, just in some subtle ways, it would have given the movie some substance. Here's the one I really thought they were going to go after. Is the invasion of technology in our lives. We even see Tony Stark wearing something like Google Glass, and he and Pepper have this conversation about him letting it take over his life, maybe even leading to this breakdown. And I thought, interesting, let's see how they pursue that. Completely gets forgotten. The movie seems to put all its weight in having something besides its effects in this anxiety basket. Mm-hmm. And as I said, that did not work for me. If that made the character more interesting to you,
it did.
I guess it could carry the film, but to me, it was a complete ploy in that let's try to give this guy some depth the third time around. And so we're going to give him nervous breakdowns that pop up every once in a while to remind people this guy has some depth.
Nothing's been the same since New York.
Oh, really? Well, I didn't notice that at all.
You experience things, and then they're over, and you still can't explain them. Gods, aliens, other dimensions. I'm just a man in a can.
The only reason I haven't cracked up is probably because you moved in, which is great. I love you. I'm lucky. But honey, I can't sleep. You go to bed. I come down here. I do what I know. I tinker. But
threat is imminent, and I have to protect the one thing that I can't live without. That's you. And my suits, they're,
machines.
They're part of me.
A distraction.
Maybe.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing Iron Man 3, the first big blockbuster of the summer. I guess I would give Shane Black more credit and suggest that giving him some depth, it felt true to this character and true to this character at this point in his life and at this point in the franchise and not just some kind of cheap ploy for the screenplay. So that worked for me. I am going to get into one area. Well, I'm going to dance around an area where I think it dropped the ball along the lines that you're suggesting, but I want to say a few more things first about what I did like about the movie. And I think the screenplay, I touched on the Shane Black voice that he has here, I do think it works very well. And I'll go back to a sequence where he lands in the middle of Tennessee. And tonally, it's a bit odd, and it takes you by surprise that all of a sudden Tony Stark has this extended sequence with a young boy. How old is he? Maybe about 10 years
old. Yeah, that sounds right.
I think. And he's a precocious kid. He's smart. He's obviously into science. I'm not sure any part of that sequence in Tennessee is actually believable or realistic in any way, but it worked. I think a lot of their banter is really successful, and it injects some heart into this movie and into the franchise without being sappy in any way, and I would give Black credit for that.
I'd agree with you that in terms of the wit, I didn't really find much heart there, but it felt very much to me when it first started like another screenwriting ploy. But you're right. Downey Jr. and the boy played by Ty Simpkins, they have a good chemistry,
they do.
And they make that wisecracking work that Black has written for them. So that I kind of dreaded when I saw it where it was going, but they did pull it off.
And that sequence is also one that ends with a battle scene or an action sequence that, as I suggested, I was a fan of, where he does battle with two adversaries, and you get the sense that for one of the first times in this franchise, he's genuinely in trouble. He's mostly defenseless, so you get that sense of danger, and you genuinely wonder how he's going to get himself out of that situation. And I like one of the bad guys, the main henchman here, James Badge Dale, is an actor who, I was the only guy who watched that AMC show, Rubicon, and I liked him on it. And then he was my scene stealer of 2012 for his one long scene in Flight. He's a really talented actor, and I love how he's menacing here as a bad guy without playing it that way at all. He's just really straightforward, and yet somehow that makes him even more scary.
That didn't lean too heavily on Terminator 2 Judgment Day for you. I mean, it felt like it was going beyond a nod. You didn't even think about it?
No, I didn't think about Terminator 2 at all as I watched this film.
It goes way beyond a nod to a direct steal in terms of the villains and their powers and how...
Okay, no, I didn't feel that way at all, and I am a big fan of that movie. Does every joke land here? No, absolutely not, but enough did, and I can't think of another actor who could make that dialogue crackle and infuse it with some gravitas and bring a deep emotional core to it all the way Robert Downey Jr. does. This is still an action, adventure, fantasy movie, if you will, but I think what Shane Black brought to it and what Robert Downey Jr. brought to it is a way to ground it in reality, to ground it in relationships, back from this realm of aliens, of Avengers and Asgard and all that, and did strip it down and make it more personal until it gets lost in its finale a little bit, but stripping it down and making it more personal worked for me.
You mentioned the Avengers, and I wonder if this was a distraction for you at all. I know all of these Marvel films have worked this way, where they're referencing to each other, or there are even cameos. And sometimes it works for me, sometimes it doesn't. Captain America, which I did like overall, sort of ended up being, at the finale, a trailer for the next Marvel movie. Here, Stark mentions the Avengers so much that I was distracted more than I've been in other films about it, to the point that during this finale, while we're thinking he's really had it, there's no one here to help him, I just kept wondering, why doesn't he call the Avengers?
I thought about that from the very beginning.
I mean, it's starting to be a problem. I know the intent, and this happens in comic books. When you read comic books, you're aware that others are within the same universe, having their own adventures, whatever, and it doesn't really seem to be as distracting.
Mm-hmm.
But here, for some reason, I don't know if it's the frequency of the movies or just how it's woven into the story here, it seemed to deflate what was going on screen.
I agree with you. I did think about that from really the first point that the Avengers is invoked, and then from the first time we see the Mandarin and we see just how strong of an opponent
he's going to be. Yeah, it's a global assault, right.
Right, and so you wonder, where's S.H.I.E.L.D. in all this? And I'm sure maybe someone out there who knows these comic books is going to say, well, this is why S.H.I.E.L.D. couldn't get involved, whatever. But this seems like the Avengers might have been able to step in here, and I'm not sure what they were up to. So you're right, that was a distraction.
Maybe they just shouldn't mention it in these films. I don't know if that's the way to go.
I certainly didn't know going into Iron Man 3 that it was going to pick up right where Avengers left off. Ultimately, I'm not opposed to them doing that, but you're right. Maybe if they had actually mentioned Avengers less, it would have been less distracting.
Here's a little holiday greeting I've been wanting to send to the Mandarin. I just didn't know how to phrase it until now. My name is Tony Stark, and I'm not afraid of you. I know you're a coward. So I've decided that you just died, pal. I'm gonna come get the body. There's no politics here, it's just good old-fashioned revenge. It's no Pentagon, it's just you and me. And on the off chance you're a man, here's my home address. 10880 Malibu Point, 90265. I'll leave the door unlocked.
This is going to be hard for me to articulate because this is the biggest spoiler of the movie that I'm not going to get into. I'll dance around it. I'm going to say that where the movie really hooked me is a scene I can only describe as Tony coming face to face with the Mandarin. That's the scene for me that crystallized, Josh, what I think Black is really playing with, which is what happens when you can no longer separate yourself from the character you're playing. When your alter ego starts to consume your ego and becomes indistinguishable from who you really are. And I thought that was interesting. And feeding off of that is this idea the movie introduces right from the beginning. I think it's the first line of the film in voiceover, which you sort of expect from Shane Black, and we do get it here. You have Robert Downey Jr. saying something about how we create our own demons. And at first, I just thought he's referring to the psychological issues that Tony Stark has, his own past mistakes. And that's part of it. But it's also about how easy it is, I think, to buy a person as evil or buy a person as good simply because they look the part, because the optics of it match our expectations, and because they play a role we need them to play in our lives. That's where I think Shane Black is actually getting at something that is halfway topical and is something we can take away from this film. Again, it's mostly about entertainment, but if you're going to look for those elements, I can find the elements that are actually semi-profound too. And there's a moment where Tony meets the Mandarin where the movie shifts a little bit, and there was a genuinely exciting moment for me watching this film.
I think you're looking for way too much in a film that has Jon Favreau as a supporting actor. So
yeah, I wish he wasn't in the film, but I'm not going to hold that against him. That worked, and if you think about it, actually, again, I don't think Black is really focused on that, but if you think about every character in this film, and even Jon Favreau's character fits into this, everybody is playing a role. Everybody is playing a character. They're trying to wear a certain outfit or behave a certain way that they think they're supposed to behave. It's all about role-playing, which makes sense in this meta world of Shane Black, and I thought that was halfway interesting enough to carry me through this film.
The scene with the Mandarin and Ben Kingsley is really good in it. That is quite a funny scene. It worked for me. It got me. Let's just say that. And so, yeah, I did appreciate that part of the film, too.
Okay, so now that I've tried to defend this movie that, frankly, I'm barely recommending, but it is a movie I can recommend, the big issues for me are the fact that the look of the film was sort of striking and disappointing in just how not striking it was. It seemed a lot like a TV movie to me. Aside from the big spectacle set pieces and all the CGI, any scene that just involved characters sitting down, there's a conversation that happens at one point between Rhodey, Don Cheadle, and Robert Downey Jr., and they're at, it looks like an Applebee's type of place. They're at some bar eating some food and talking, and it seems like it is something straight out of a TV sitcom. There's just something
I can see that now you mention images, and
nothing about the world that we're seeing visually was vivid to me. So that was a little bit of a disappointment. I already touched on the other one, which is similar to Iron Man, one of my reservations with the film. And of course, in keeping with what you'd expect from the third film in a big budget franchise, the last 20 minutes or so does become tedious and tiresome, and it is set up at the beginning of the film. I'll give Shane Black that. It's not like they just introduced all these new Iron Men figures because they could. It's set up from the very beginning of the film. Nevertheless, there's too much chaos. There's too much just random destruction for no good reason. There's too many unrealistic things happening, even in this world of Iron Man, that the stakes that were supposed to be so high actually just kept getting lowered and lowered as things became more and more absurd. So that really left me feeling like Shane Black, in the end, couldn't help himself from getting bigger, louder, dumber, because the sequel kind of required that.
Didn't you sort of feel like you were in an Iron Man showroom? Like they were bringing out the next robot for you to look at and, what would I name him? Maybe I'll buy that one.
Right.
And then the next one would come with a different power. And, I kind of like that power. I was surprised they didn't have them as you walked out of the theater to purchase the doll,
you wanted. It does. It does kind of feel like that. And the other one, this again gets back to a little bit of a spoiler, but you talk about the politics of the film. The movie introduces a thread that you think it's going down a really interesting political angle, because we discover, this is why he goes to Tennessee, that there is some crossover between an accident that happened with a soldier, a U.S. soldier who's come back to the U.S. after fighting in Iraq or Afghanistan, presumably, and what the Mandarin is up to. And that's what he's investigating there in Tennessee. Nothing spoilerish there. Then we get some more information and we get some more insight into that, and it introduces a really interesting angle with regard to American soldiers and thinking about them coming back from battle and what they're suffering from. And because the movie introduces it, you think Shane Black is going to go down that path, and he completely discards it. And then by the end of the film, when we're watching this big finale, when we're watching the good guys battle the quote-unquote bad guys, because of the information we learned earlier, it completely changes our perspective. At least it completely changed my perspective on the scene and what exactly was taking place. And it altered my sympathies even a little bit. And Shane Black just didn't seem interested in that, unfortunately.
I think you're completely right. I mean, we're chiding each other here about looking too deeply into these Iron Man films, but I'm serious about it.
No, they introduced those elements.
They introduced the elements, and all along, because there have been real-world parallels that have been really interesting. And I guess that's why I'm a little bit harder on this film, even though it is primarily supposed to be entertainment, is because the first movie did show me that it was capable of being both simultaneous. So I wanted that, ideally. If I didn't get that, I wanted it to be fun, like I thought Iron Man 2 was. Didn't get either, so yeah. It's the least of the franchise for me.
Okay. Fun enough for me and right in the middle after Iron Man 1. It's out now in wide release, of course. If you see Iron Man 3 and agree or disagree with our takes, you can send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Last week, Adam and I played middle schoolers in Massacre Theater. This week, we'll graduate to high school. Plus, in anticipation of The Great Gatsby, the Film Spotting poll considers Leonardo DiCaprio's definitive performance. Stay with us. This is all there is. Don't wake me for the fight. I'd rather be alone, asleep, not weary for a break tonight. Don't be a ghost. Don't hurry for the lights. The canopy of lights.
Folks, sorry to interrupt, but we did want to jump in for a second to once again mention our sponsors this week, including Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now online store. You can check out their new commerce solution so you can start selling stuff immediately. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/film and use the offer code FILM5. We're also brought to you once again by Shutterstock.com.
At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project, you can choose from over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in high definition. Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Shutterstock also adds 10,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new.
And Shutterstock is a complete offering. They have excellent customer service, flexible pricing, and you can choose between individual clips or video packs. You can also download most clips in HD. If you want to try Shutterstock today, just sign up for a free account. You don't need your credit card. Just start the account. Begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM5, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM5. We thank Shutterstock for their support. To know where secrets go. We could start a fire and watch it grow. We could bury our shoes and wait for rain. Till the summer takes us home.
Drop it!
Relax! You're late, all right? My name's Alan, Barry Allen, United States Secret Service. Your boy just tried to jump out the window. My partner has him in custody.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What, you think the FBI are the only ones on this guy? I mean, come on. Come on, he's dabbling in government checks here. I've been following a paper trail on this guy for months now. Hey, you mind taking that gun out of my face? Please, really. I mean, it makes me nervous.
You see some credentials.
Yeah, sure. Take my whole wallet.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks from Steven Spielberg's very good film, Catch Me If You Can. And we're thinking about DiCaprio as we look ahead to next week's review of The Great Gatsby. And we'll ponder Leo DiCaprio's definitive performance with your help a bit later in this segment. But right now, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this movie.
No one even asked me if I took the milk money that time. I just got a 3-day vacation.
Did you take it?
Yeah, I took it. You knew I took it. Teddy knew I took it. Everyone knew I took it. Even Vern knew it, I think. Maybe I was sorry and I tried to give it back.
You tried to give it back?
Maybe. Just maybe. And maybe I took it to old Lady Simons and told her, and the money was all there. But I still got a 3-day vacation because it never showed up. And maybe the next week, old Lady Simons had this brand new sugar on when she came to school.
Yeah, it was brown and had dots on it.
Yeah. So let's just say that I stole the milk money, but old Lady Simons stole it back from me. Just suppose that I told this story. Me, Chris Chambers, kid brother to Eyeball Chambers. Do you think that anyone would have believed it?
That was Will Wheaton as Gordy and River Phoenix as Chris in 1986's Stand By Me, directed by Rob Reiner, written by Reynold Gideon and Bruce A. Evans, of course, from the Stephen King novella.
There you go. We heard from many listeners who got the tie-in to our discussion last week of the new Jeff Nichols film, Mud. Jesse Keller says, I kept thinking of Rob Reiner's Kids on a Mission coming-of-age film as I was watching Mud. Young protagonists going deep into the dangerous wilderness to see something spectacular, whether it's a boat in a tree or the dead body of Ray Brower. Nicely done.
Also heard from Pat Galvin from Anchorage, Alaska. Great tie-in to Mud. I was reminded constantly of that film while watching Mud. Even a physical resemblance between River Phoenix's character and Neckbone.
I actually said that very same thing to you, Josh, before we performed the scene last week because I just come from Mud and we'd already picked out Stand By Me, but after seeing Mud, mm-hmm. I knew that it was the perfect film to do because I had that same sense watching the actor who plays Neckbone, that he looked a lot like a young River Phoenix. And then, of course, you have the main character in Mud who looks a little bit like Will Wheaton. He's the darker-haired kid. So you have the two boys who seem very similar to me. Things worked out well. Sometimes we actually know what we're doing here on Massacre Theater. If you want to hear our version of that scene and our review of Mud, plus our top five most anticipated summer movies, you can find that show at filmspotting.net or get it via iTunes. It was not a record setting week for Massacre Theater entries, Josh, but
we got a fair amount more
than we saw for Zardoz the week before.
That's not saying much.
Why don't you reach into that hat and pick out this week's winner?
The winner would be Todd Hiller from Washington, D.C.
Congratulations, Todd. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
It's a scene, man. Memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's got to be Marlon Brando. To do this job, you gotta be a great actor. You gotta be naturalistic. You gotta be naturalistic as hell.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Filmspotting listeners get the first 30 days free. And Josh, I was looking at Fandor just last night, seeing what had been added. 15 new films added to Fandor over the past 7 days. The one that really jumped out to me is a movie called Of Dolls and Murder. It's a crime documentary from 2012 that got me with this description. Before forensics, DNA, and CSI, we had dollhouses, an unimaginable collection of miniature crime scenes known as the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death.
Of course there's a documentary about that.
It almost sounds too good to be true. There's right. No way this is really it. This must be a mock documentary, but I'm fascinated. And that's one of the new films available currently over at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Let's get into our scene for this week. You're right, we have gone from middle schoolers to now slightly more older teens.
Not necessarily more mature.
No. In fact, probably less mature. And I love this selection because this is a movie, and this will be a hint for some longtime listeners who know the movies that I have a particular affinity for and nostalgic connection to. I'm giving just all sorts of hints this week. This is one of those films. So maybe just knowing that is enough to help clue you in to what movie we're massacring. And I'm going to take the lead role here, I guess, because I have such affection for this film.
I believe you said you don't even need a script. You have this memorized.
I can go off book if I have to.
Let's see it.
All right. I'm going to start it off. So you're going to give me the action, but we will also note quickly that there's a name in the scene. We've changed that name. I don't know why, because this scene is obvious the way it is, but just to make it less Googleable, if that's the proper word, Josh.
Yeah, I think it is.
I'm ready.
And action.
Do you know what I would like to do?
Shower with them.
Then bang, we hit the city, baby, dead on. For a little drinks, a little nightlife, a little dancing.
Dancing.
We'll throw a huge party. I mean, huge party. Everyone's invited. Women everywhere. All these girls, they're all there. Naked bodies everywhere. They all know my name.
Jason.
What?
Nobody likes us. Nobody.
Why are you messing with the fantasy? We know about the reality. Don't ruin the fantasy, okay? And then we're a hit. Man, we're popular. We're revered.
Man.
We're studs. When the smoke clears, right? Those two dames fall amazingly, completely, and totally in love with us.
And scene. That's pretty much the pre-show pep talk you give
that
me
is
every
actually,
week.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, May 14th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
There are two kinds of people in the world, my friend. Those with a rope around their neck and the people who have the job of doing the cutting. Listen. The neck at the end of the rope is mine. I run the risks. So the next time I want more than half.
You may run the risks, my friend, but I do the cutting. If we cut down my percentage. Cigar? Liable to interfere with my aim.
That scene from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly featuring the great Clint Eastwood, and I'm going to say it, the equally great Eli Wallach as
Equally,
Tuca.
Huh?
Yeah, he's pretty fantastic.
All right.
In that Sergio Leone classic film, it is the third film in the trilogy, commonly referred to as the Dollars Trilogy or the Man with No Name Trilogy, I believe it also goes by, Josh.
That's the one I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, and as we were thinking about Iron Man 3 this week, we asked you on our last show, of series with three films and no more than three, which of these third films is your favorite? Your choices were Army of Darkness from Sam Raimi, The Bourne Ultimatum, The Dark Knight Rises, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, The Return of the King, or Toy Story 3 from Pixar. How did it come out, Josh?
There's a tie for last place. 8% went to Army of Darkness and The Bourne Ultimatum. Right close to that with 9% was The Dark Knight Rises. And then we'll jump up a little bit for my pick. The Return of the King received 18% of the vote. Second place, though, went to Toy Story 3 with 27% of the vote and just squeaking out a win, 29%, to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
So Good, the Bad, and the Ugly does win, as I figured it would. I didn't think it'd be that close, though. I know that there are many fans of Toy Story 3. I'm one of them. But I also know that a lot of people really think about that as the lesser film of the trilogy. They like Toy Story 1 and 2 better, and so I didn't know if that would hurt it in this poll question, but it came out good.
Were you a little surprised at how well The Return of the King did, since you scoffed?
I did scoff, even though
at my choice.
I have no business to scoff because I haven't seen it. And speaking of not having seen movies, I also admitted, I confessed my shame last week, that I hadn't seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly either, so I couldn't really, frankly, participate in this poll question with any validity whatsoever, or any credibility whatsoever. I have since rectified that, Josh.
And are you changing your vote?
I am changing my vote. Film Spotting listeners did get it right.
Well, especially when you originally voted The Bourne Ultimatum.
I'm standing by The Bourne Ultimatum as a great film. I love that movie quite a bit, but I would go with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I had a chance actually to hang out with our producer over the weekend, Sam Van Halgren. We both needed to rectify that blind spot, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. We sat down, we watched it. We both enjoyed it quite a bit. I did write about the movie a little bit, just a brief capsule over on Letterboxd. If you're not following me there, that's letterboxd.com/filmspotting, and that's B-O-X-D, no E there in Letterboxd. And we'll put a link to that as well in the notes for the show over at filmspotting.net. We heard from many listeners with comments on our poll. This is the no way he has that many consonants in his name note, Mark Pizzola.
You're going to have to spell that now.
P-S-Z-C-Z-O-L-A.
Wow. Yeah, I don't believe that.
No, it's a mouthful. He says The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the best film of the selection, but also my favorite film of all time, so maybe I'm biased.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. Brandon suggested, honestly, how can any of you be voting against The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly in this poll? It's in another league. Toy Story 3, Army of Darkness, and Return of the King all have strengths, sure, but The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a damn masterwork. I will be embarrassed for Film Spotting Nation if this poll doesn't come out right. Well,
thank goodness. Thank goodness.
What a relief.
Joel wrote in with a very pithy and poetic note, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly's grandeur over Return of the King's spectacle. There are few better ways to show the cosmic devastation of war than to use war as a backdrop for an intensely personal conflict between three killers, only to spiral down to just those three killers in a circular graveyard closing in on their bodies, then their faces, then their eyes. I wish I had written that. I may just copy and paste that over into my review.
It's a little late now.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, Baird suggested, my vote depends on how I want to interpret the question. Of all these films, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is by far the best crafted film. However, if I was to determine which of these films is the best film and closes out the story arc of its two predecessors, then it would have to be a shootout between Jason Bourne and Woody.
Wow, so that is in keeping with the film spotting tradition of overthinking everything, and I respect that, Baird.
I think Baird should be included on some of the poll emails that go back and forth. He could be helpful.
Yeah, we'll close with a couple Fire the Intern notes. James Hawes says, if I had to pick the best third movie of all time, it would be Three Colors Red. I'm kind of shocked you left that off the list, actually, unless you thought it would have an unfair advantage given your audience.
Martin Teller said, voted The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, but how do you not include Kieslowski's Three Colors Red, or Bergman's The Silence, or Ray's The World of Apu? And maybe this is a technicality, but doesn't Bourne Legacy invalidate Ultimatum?
Wow, there's a lot to dive into there. Going back to James, of course, they were reviewed here on the show as part of our Kieslowski Marathon. I'm a fan of Red. I don't like Red as much as Blue, but that is a trilogy that probably should have been included in our poll question. So actually, we're going to fire not an intern, but our producer this week for that one.
That
Sam,
seems
sorry.
A little harsh. How about we just get a competency test for these interns? Let's start there.
Okay, we'll start there. The Bergman one is good as well. I didn't think about the Faith trilogy, though that's a pretty loose trilogy. That really is more just based on theme. If I remember correctly, I don't think Bergman ever conceived those movies as three movies, which I think is probably different than the other films we're talking about. And unfortunately, when you talk about Apu and the trilogy from Satyajit Ray, those are just films I haven't seen. Those are blind spots.
Let's do a marathon at some point on those, because I have not seen any of those either.
Yeah, that would be a great marathon. One of those films that I'm not going to butcher right now by trying to pronounce it is a film that always comes up in the Sight and Sound list discussions. Mm-hmm. I believe the translated name would be Song of the Little Road, so I'll phrase it that way. But those are films by Ray that I really do need to see, and maybe that will make for a fine marathon at some point down the road. That brings us to this week's poll question. As we suggested at the top of the segment, we're thinking about The Great Gatsby. Actually, I'm trying not to think about it at all, and it's not hard because I just don't really care about this film at all, even though it stars Carey Mulligan.
How do these movies that you don't care about end up on our viewing list?
I don't know. I
seems
just,
to be a problem for you.
I guess I just assume that listeners expect us to weigh in on The Great Gatsby, Josh. And Leo DiCaprio, of course, is playing the titular character, Jay Gatsby. And I'm sure we've asked some variation on this question before as we've looked at films that star DiCaprio. So I apologize if this is redundant to anyone out there, but we're phrasing it maybe a little bit differently. It's not so much what's your favorite Leo DiCaprio performance, but which one do you think is the definitive one? If you had to put this performance into a vault, into a pantheon, which one is it? The choices are
Billy Costigan from The Departed, Kelvin Candy from the recent Django Unchained, Cobb from Inception, Frank Abagnale Jr. from Catch Me If You Can, Howard Hughes from The Aviator, he was Oscar nominated for that one, and then Jack Dawson from Titanic, of course, and we're also going to give the option of other.
We will give you that option. You can write in your choice, and also please do leave us a comment there in the polls if you want to explain your choice and why you went with other. But I think we covered the big performances. I don't know where I'm going with this one, Josh. This is another tough one for me. What about you?
The phrasing helps because I think DiCaprio is one of those actors. He can have a definitive performance because he does some things very well. I don't know how much of a range he has. And that's when he's a little bit squirrely, a little bit deceptive. So Catch Me If You Can would be one way to go. That's probably my second choice. But ultimately, I'm going to go with Billy Costigan from The Departed. Yeah,
that's where I'm leaning right now, too. But for me, it's between the three options. You mentioned two of them, Frank Abagnale and Catch Me If You Can. Billy Costigan for The Departed, and I have to throw Candy in there from Django Unchained just because I really love that performance, talked about it a lot at the end of last year, but that's also a supporting
That's what I was just going to say, yeah.
Him. And I feel like if you're going to put one away into the pantheon, into this DiCaprio vault, then maybe it should be a lead role, and along those lines, it's maybe hard to put the one away where he does a Boston accent, and you can debate how good that accent is, but I love the different layers he brings to Billy Costigan and all the existential angst that comes through in DiCaprio's performance. So right now, I'm going there as well. We'll see if we swayed our listeners at all. We want to know what you think. Please don't go down that path just because we did. Share your opinion by voting now at filmspotting.net. And as we said, you can also leave a comment there in the poll question to explain your choice. One final note, Josh, you mentioned future marathons. We've already announced and gotten a lot of feedback from our listeners that our next marathon is going to be a Korean auteurs marathon. That's a real blind spot for us. And I thought the best way to go about this would be to actually just start a letterboxed list that accumulates the various suggestions that have come in from listeners, along with some of the other ones I've sought out for myself. And there are some big names. There are some notable auteurs that people think of right away when they think of contemporary Korean cinema. And again, a lot of the feedback has come in. We've seen great titles. I think the list probably is up to about 35 right now.
Wow.
There's a lot more I haven't added. So it's going to be hard, I think, to actually cull through them and finalize it down to 4 to 6. But I think we can do it. And anyone who has thoughts on this marathon or wants to make a case for certain Korean films that we need to talk about, we just absolutely have to talk about, go to letterboxd.com/filmspotting, find that Korean auteurs list, and you can comment there and suggest a movie there as well. We'll also link to that in the notes for the show at filmspotting.net.
I stopped by the Apple Genius Bar for help compiling my list of the top movie minds.
Nicely
they
done.
Just kept suggesting Steve Jobs, so this might be a short conversation. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us. When we were kids, we believed in everything. There's only one thing left to believe in now that we're old. And it's the one thing I cannot ignore, that you're always on.
Thank you, time here on the show. 7 new listeners decided, Josh, to finally pay the dealer, and we appreciate every little bit that we get. We start with 2 new, incredibly generous $10 a month subscribers, including Jocelyn in Geneva, Switzerland, and Kagan in Salt Lake City, Utah.
I've been a loyal listener of Film Spotting since 2006, when I was an aspiring filmmaker in high school. I always dreamed of being a director or cinematographer, but after attending a month-long film workshop in LA when I was 15, I came to realize that I had no talent for operating a camera.
Yeah, it's rough when you have that moment of realization. I had it myself.
Did you? Discouraged, I returned home and continued to listen to Film Spotting and watch movies that were recommended on the show. Since that time, I've switched gears to focus on my music, and I will be graduating with a degree in music composition this Friday. However, thanks to Film Spotting, I have maintained a great love for film, and I've started my career composing music for film. I've already scored about 10 short films and am currently scoring 2 features. Film Spotting has not only inspired me to pursue my career in film, but has also educated me enough about film as to not humiliate myself in front of directors. For my graduation, I am upping my monthly donation. I look forward to being able to make larger contributions in the future, and I hope someday that I will write music for a film that will be reviewed on Film Spotting.
We hope that happens as well. Best of luck, Kagan. Thank you so much, and I think maybe that's yet another Film Spotting tagline. Film Spotting, so you won't be humiliated.
Yes, I like that.
Okay. A new gold-level donor, Jason in L.A. And this is Jason, who is a member of our Film Spotting Advisory Board, Josh. He's basically an unpaid volunteer who helps us out with top 5 ideas, and he chimes in from time to time. He's a great guy. I've met him multiple times when I've been out in L.A., hung out with him. There's no reason whatsoever he should be sending us a gold-level donation.
He's paying us to let us have him do
hire
work
him
for us
and not pay him.
Got it.
Right.
Okay.
It's a nice racket that apparently we've discovered. Thank you, Jason. Two new $5 a month subscribers, Brian right here in Chicago and Jamie in Vancouver, BC. We also got this nice note from Patricia Robb. I hope I'm saying that right. She's in Binghamton, New York, and she's a new Buck a Show donor.
Saturday, April 27 was my 52nd birthday, and it occurred to me as I spent it enjoying amazing films at the Tribeca Film Festival that it was time, past time, for me to express my appreciation for film spotting and all it has meant to me. I started listening around show number 349. At that time, I was driving back and forth from Binghamton, New York, home to my hometown in Ventnor, New Jersey, to help out my aging father. It was an anxious time, and I came to depend on film spotting, not just to pass the hours in the car, but to engage me in thinking critically and imaginatively about my lifelong passion for films, while at the same time lifting me out of my day-to-day worries. Soon you guys became like family. Well, not family. Maybe those weird guys in the college dorm who were really, really smart about something I was really interested in. In the almost 2 years since, film spotting has become a weekly ritual for me, whether I'm traveling long distances or listening in short bursts around town. The addition of Josh to the program has been terrific, and I join your legion of fans for whom Josh's acting chops make Massacre Theater an even more fabulous experience. I have turned my actor son onto film spotting, and my partner too. We all eagerly await the weekly reviews, the marathons, and the humor that make film spotting so enjoyable as well as informative.
Patricia goes on to say, so in honor of my 52nd birthday, here's a Buck a Show to show my appreciation and to tell you that film spotting is a not to be missed part of my week. Keep up the good work. Patricia missed us as well at Tribeca, a film festival I've yet to be able to make it out to. And Patricia shares with us, and we wanted to share these with our listeners as well. These are some titles maybe to have on your radar if they sound interesting to you. Some narrative films Patricia responded to: Before Snowfall, about honor killings in Kurdistan; The Patient Stone, about a woman coping in an Afghani war zone; The Pretty One, Twins, Zoe Kazan, and a great script; The Reluctant Fundamentalist, this is Mira Nair's treatment of the amazing novel about a young, ambitious Pakistani man whose life changes after 9/11. Run and Jump, a family coping after a stroke ravages the personality of the father; and A Single Shot, a man's whole world is changed by, you guessed it, a single shot. Excellent Q&A with director David Rosenthal and Sam Rockwell. And Patricia has a documentary pick as well, Oxiana, about Oceana, West Virginia, where approximately 80% of the population is addicted to OxyContin. Won Best New Director for Sean Dunn, as well as a special jury mention. So some really fascinating sounding films there. Thank you, Patricia, for sharing those. One final donation and one final note from a longtime listener, Martin Cuevas in Brooklyn, New York, who took my recommendation and when they were in Chicago recently, went to the Music Box, which has been showing Shane Carruth's Upstream Color. He did not, Martin, have a great, overwhelmingly positive reaction to it, but he gives us a little bit more of his thoughts.
Like Primer, though, the damn thing sticks in your head, and after a few days of contemplation, I feel I need to see it again. The thing could have been approached so much differently, which perhaps might have opened it up to a wider audience. I'm eager to hear you guys go over it, if you ever get around to doing so.
Get in line.
All that being said, I'm happy to have at least made one $5 donation, which is in the mail. Being an undergrad makes it unfortunately difficult to contribute any more at this time. I've been a big fan since the early Maddie days and have appreciated the show and all it has to offer. I'm consistently inspired to seek out intelligent discussions about film after listening. Looking forward to many more great film recommendations like Another Earth, Primer, and horrible Massacre Theater performances. Adam's Shepherd book, Death Scene from Serenity, still haunts me to this day.
You can also get in line on that one. I love the fact that one of my Massacre Theater performances is the one that haunts a listener.
Mine are so good.
That's true. Thank you, Martin, for that. And thank you to all of our listeners for the incredibly kind words. We really do appreciate not only your donations, but what you have to say every week and about what the show means to you. And speaking of kind comments, we'll get to one more bit of kindness here in a second, but we did want to acknowledge our musical guest this week, our featured artist, Air Review. They're a band from Dallas, Texas. You heard songs from the new album Low Wishes. The songs were Rebel and Young, and this is a band that came to us, Josh, via a listener named Marcia Gomez, who's from Dallas. And I like what I heard. Sam liked what he heard. We decided to feature them on the show. If you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, you'll have a couple chances to see Air Review live on May 17th and 18th. If you like what you hear, more information available at airreview.net. We also want to help promote our partner, Jeff Goldsmith, and his Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith podcast. Just do a search in iTunes if you want to hear his great interviews with screenwriters, or find the link in our show notes. And, of course, we do want to help share a little bit of love for MoviePass, which gives you the opportunity to see unlimited movies in theaters nationwide for a flat monthly subscription rate. Just go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and use the offer code filmspotting to get $10 off your first month. So Josh, where I wanted to close was with this final note from a listener who is just describing himself as a devoted listener in Western Kansas, who sent us a lovely handwritten note and also a check inside for the biggest single donation
really
we've ever gotten in the history of the show.
Wow.
In 8+ years. And he requested that we didn't read his note on air, but he did have a request that we express and acknowledge our gratitude with a song to close out the segment. I think he picked one of the all-time best, and we're happy to oblige.
There are places I remember.
Hey, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners, Matt Singer here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. In our latest episode, Allison Wilmore and I delve into Jane Campion's 6-hour miniseries mystery, Top of the Lake.
And since Campion is one of New Zealand's best-known directors, alongside Peter Jackson, of course, we're going to take a look at some other films either set in New Zealand or from New Zealand filmmakers that are available on streaming and VOD sites like Hulu and Netflix. To listen, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes or go to filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, my name's Steve Coogan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Donations. You want me to make a donation to the Coast Guard Youth Auxiliary.
Doc, I'm from the future. I came here in a time machine that you invented. Now I need your help to get back to the year 1985.
My God, do you know what this means? It means that this damn thing doesn't work at all.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Who else there but Michael J. Fox as Marty McFly and Christopher Lloyd as Dr. Emmett Brown? I think Doc Brown was the first character that popped into our heads,
yeah.
Josh, as we thought about this week's top five movie geniuses. This is a tie-in with our discussion earlier in the show of Tony Stark and Iron Man 3. And if I'm not mistaken, I think we just recently had a Doc Brown memorial list for our top five crackpots.
He the memorial?
I think it was,
okay,
actually. But that's fine. We
crackpot
love Back
genius.
To the Future. And there is some crossover with crackpots and genius, and I did go back to my list to see if any of those people were represented. I have five completely different characters, and actually it was not even a question for me this time. I had five geniuses that didn't really overlap with the crackpots at all. But how did you form your list? This seems like it would be one of the easier ones we've done.
It was in a sense that so many came to mind immediately, and there were just a ton to pick from as you started compiling them, and suggestions started coming in via Twitter and so forth. So I tried basically not to have too much crossover, not all evil geniuses or all doctor scientist types.
Okay.
There are a couple repetitions, but I tried to balance out a little bit in terms of genre too. And we'll see. It's a bit of a mix.
Yeah, I didn't really think about any of those things, and maybe it just didn't pop up. I had enough variety in my choices. The one clear distinction I drew, though, was wanting intellectual geniuses, I guess you'd call them, and not artistic ones.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going prodigies for me personally, like any of the characters in Searching for Bobby Fischer, or you think about movies like Shine or even Mozart and Amadeus. For me, the intellect had to be the dominant factor here, and it had to be a direct part of the conflict. I did think about that in terms of what's driving the drama, is that their intellectual capacity is part of their problem, essentially. And that's why, for example, I know we saw this on Twitter when we threw out there that we were doing geniuses. A lot of people said, well, Dr. Strangelove. I mean, Dr. Strangelove, you talk about the evil scientist or the mad scientist.
Yeah.
But the movie's not really about, for me, that character, despite it being in the title. That's not really what the film is dealing with. So it didn't seem appropriate for me in this case, but I'm sure we'll get some people who will argue to the contrary. What's your number five?
Well, my number five definitely sticks with that. As a matter of fact, The Intellect is right there in the title, A Beautiful Mind, John Nash. Russell Crowe plays the Princeton mathematician and Nobel Prize winner in this biopic. It's from director Ron Howard. It won Best Picture, won Best Director. It's normally the sort of Oscar film that I just resist. But this one does have a little bit of an edge and some trickiness to it. So I think it rises above that sort of middle-brow Oscar picture, it sounds like, on paper at least. And this especially is the case after Nash is recruited by the U.S. government for his decoding skills.
We've been intercepting radio transmissions from Moscow.
Computer can't detect a pattern, but I'm sure it's code.
Why is that, General?
Ever just know something, Dr. Nash?
Constantly.
Crowe has both the cockiness that's needed for the young Nash, and then he also lets this vulnerability come in when his own mind does begin to turn on him. He begins to suffer from paranoia and hallucinations. And the movie depicts this interior experience really vividly. So it's not your standard fawning biopic. It's something actually closer to the fractured psyche of Fight Club. That's the movie I thought of while watching A Beautiful Mind, even though stylistically they're very different in temperament. They're different as well. I think Ron Howard is an interesting director. I can't say that I've ever been excited about hearing him being attached to a project. I don't know if I ever will be, but he's made some really strong films, Apollo 13, Cinderella Man, and I'd count this among them.
You know what? I'm with you. I like not only the character and Russell Crowe's performance, I like the film. And I will throw out as one partial disclaimer that I haven't seen it since I saw it in theaters when it came out, and I saw it once, but I didn't really understand the backlash against it. Yes, I do see, as you described, Josh, how it seems to fit into this kind of classic prestige Oscar picture, and that it's the kind of Best Picture winner that you would hope would lose out to something more challenging and more
artistic. Something edgier, yeah.
But going back to the other films that were nominated that year, and I don't have them off the top of my head, I'm not sure there were better candidates. I think it was the same year as Mulholland Drive. Well, that didn't get nominated for Best Picture. So
right.
I was pretty content with A Beautiful Mind winning. I do think it's a better film than a lot of people give it credit for. Of course, as always, Josh, you came prepared. You defended your choice rigorously. I don't know how rigorous I'm going to be this week, because for me, this was one of those top fives where it kind of came down to, okay, who are the really smart movie characters that I just think are the coolest or the most complicated and the most fascinating? And this is a movie for my number five that has never made a Film Spotting top five list before, which is always fun when you can bust out one of those picks. But when you talk about cool geniuses on screen, I'm going with the cult classic Buckaroo Banzai in The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. It's from 1984, stars Peter Weller. And no, this wasn't a hugely popular film. That's why it is now considered a cult classic. John Lithgow is in it as well. But he's the only genius, I'm going to say, Josh, on either of our lists who is this versatile as well as cool. He is a neurosurgeon, a particle physicist, but he's also a race car driver, a rock star, and comic book hero.
Yeah, you don't see that every day.
You can't top that. What does John Nash have on all of that? And he's even such a cool rock star, he'll stop a show mid-performance just to make sure that the cute girl in the audience is having a good time. He wants to make sure everybody's having a good time, and he really does care about her situation.
I'm down on my last nickel in this lousy town. They wouldn't even take my luggage in Hawk. I lost my room at the Y this morning.
It's cool.
Hey, no. Don't be mean. We don't have to be mean. Because, remember, no matter where you go, there you are.
He is one of these heroes who gets himself unwittingly into a situation where he gets a little bit over his head. And I noticed as I looked through my picks that that actually was a theme that developed, where these geniuses, because of their intellect that drives them down a certain path, in this case, he is experimenting and he opens a door to the eighth dimension and starts some kind of interstellar war. He ends up battling Lithgow's Lord John Worfen, I believe the character's name is. But whenever I think about Buckaroo Banzai, I think about Weller. I think about Jeff Goldblum as a member of his band slash scientist team, who is always wearing cowboy gear, including these obnoxious, like, sheepskin chaps of some kind. Those alone are worth seeing The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. And I just thought that Peter Weller as the main character was awesome. Yeah. I loved it when I was a kid. I haven't seen it since. I don't know if it holds up at all, but that's my number five.
I'd like to see it again. That would be pretty interesting. Well, you added a first-timer, film spotting first-timer anyway, for your list. I have a repeat here for number four. It's Dr. Evil of Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, which I did have recently, Mike Myers, for this exact same part when we did our top five multiple role performances last year. It's also probably debatable how much of a genius he is, but if nothing else, he's got all the trappings of the evil genius, and he definitely knows how to talk the talk.
Gentlemen, I have a plan. It's called blackmail. As you know, the royal family of Britain are the wealthiest landowners in the world. Either the royal family pays us an exorbitant amount of money, or we make it seem that Prince Charles has had an affair outside of marriage and therefore would have to divorce.
Prince Charles did have an affair. He admitted it, and they are now divorced.
Right, okay, people, you have to tell me these things, all right? I've been frozen for 30 years, okay? Throw me a frickin' bone here. I'm the boss. Need the info.
It's telling to me that of the six scenes you'll find for Austin Powers at movieclips.com, I think five of them were of Dr. Evil, and the other one was just the trailer. So Austin doesn't even really get a scene there. That just shows how much he does take over the movie, and he's, you know, become a fan favorite as well. And, you know, I guess I will stick with the genius tag because he was a genius of his own time, at least, and he's just out of his element in Austin Powers.
It's really too bad these sequels were so bad, because the first Austin Powers is genuinely funny and
it's
eminently
so
rewatchable.
Yes.
It's a very good film. I like that pick. Speaking of eminently rewatchable, at least for me, I'm going back to the 80s for my number four pick. It is the movie Real Genius. My choice is Chris Knight, played by Val Kilmer, in the film that introduced me to Val Kilmer. I know he'd been in Top Secret before, but this is where I discovered him. 1985 film directed by Martha Coolidge, who also did Valley Girl, and he's a senior on the campus of Pacific Tech. He's this genius who's working on a laser project, fittingly with Dr. Evil. In his final year, he's trying to get some fellowship and get this big job, and he ends up taking in as a roommate this freshman who's, I think, something like 15 years old, graduated high school early, named Mitch, and he kind of becomes his mentor. But as we see early on, he's not going to be quite the genius character we might expect. They have a great introduction to Chris Knight's character where he's being shown around the campus of this job he's applying for by a guy in a suit, of course, very buttoned up, and he's wearing these obnoxious 80s looking shoes, a t-shirt that says I love toxic waste, and he's got one of those headbands on they sold in the 80s like our daughters would wear now, where it's got the little balls on top that bounce. That's what he's wearing to this job interview. So he's not the stuffy nerd everyone else we see in the movie is. He's so smart, he's in control. He can play by his own rules basically and completely reject all authority, and those characters are just automatically attractive. And he does get in over his head, of course, because he helps to build a weapon for the government. He doesn't realize that that's what
that
he's
government
working on.
Again, I'm
the
telling
government,
you,
the evil government. But anybody who saw Real Genius, I think, wanted to be as smart and as cool and as hilarious as Val Kilmer is in that film.
Why is that toy on your head?
Because if I wear it anywhere else, it chafes. I'm sorry. It's just that I didn't want you guys to think I was stuffy. You know, no fun. All brain, no penis.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. It's just an infantile response to authority.
Yes, you are Chris Knight, aren't you?
I hope so. I'm wearing his underwear.
I'm so glad you picked that, because I want to say that was the most common title I saw on Facebook and Twitter when I asked. Yeah, people really have a lot of affection for
one
that
movie. One of my most quoted films ever.
Really?
I still find ways to quote Real Genius in everyday conversation. It's in my top five most quotable.
Wow. All right, my number three comes from The Royal Tenenbaums. And at first, I resisted this pick. I wasn't quite so sure about it. Partially, that's because I have to be judicious about my Wes Anderson picks. I can't just throw them all over the place. And also, I wondered, are the Tenenbaums geniuses, or are they prodigies gone awry? Are they potential geniuses? Are they poser geniuses? It, isn't quite clear, but then on Twitter, Peter Labuza came up with this phrase, and he said they have productive pathology. So I liked that. It seemed to fit and allowed me to put Gwyneth Paltrow's Margot on the list. I know this is crossing a little bit over into that artistic territory you talked about because her talent is in playwriting. She received a grant for a play that she wrote when she was a teen. I do really like Paltrow in this movie, though. She can be a strong presence when she's used well. And I think she is here. There's a flatness to her that actually works for Margot, who's secretive, who's emotionally distant, awfully mopey throughout the film. She's sort of like a missing Addams Family sibling. And she's actually adopted into the Tenenbaums, so who knows, maybe that's where she originally came from.
Yeah, that was a fantastic pick right up until the point that you gave Peter Labuza any credit whatsoever.
But pushed me over the edge.
No, The Royal Tenenbaums is an honorable mention for me. It's one I strongly considered for my top five. I think multiple characters certainly do qualify.
Yeah.
She, I'm guessing, has a high IQ, just as every other member of that family seems to as well. Ben Stiller's character definitely comes to mind as another one of the geniuses in The Royal Tenenbaums.
At this point, there would have been some discussion. Abe would, of course, want to know how. Aaron would have to explain all about the storage manifest and how it showed two rooms under the name Abram Turger. Then Abe would need to know how. Aaron would explain that when he went up there and found the failsafe running, he knew exactly what it was.
You're listening to Film Spotting, inspired by the mastermind at Stark Industries. Tony Stark and Iron Man 3, we're sharing our top five movie geniuses. And after my silly 80s picks for my number three, we'll get to some of the serious stuff. I'm going with two characters, Aaron and Abe, from the Shane Carruth movie Primer. A lot of people talking about Shane Carruth because of his more recent film, Upstream Color, a film many listeners were hoping we would discuss at some point. You've seen it, Josh. I haven't had the chance yet, but it just came out on DVD. So I've ordered it, and
nice.
I am at some point going to find the time.
And all right.
I'm sure we'll spend a few minutes at some point because I know there is that interest out there. But anyway, back to Primer, his debut film. Aaron and Abe are these guys who work out of their garage with a couple other partners. They're obviously highly skilled and highly intelligent. They're engineers. They're developing different products. And I believe it's been a long time since I saw the film. It was 2005. But they're trying to create this box, this technology that will reduce the weight of an object that goes into it. But what they end up realizing is there's a side effect in that time gets displaced for whatever object is there in the box. And I guess that's the only thing I can say about it, because otherwise I have no idea what's going on.
You're way ahead of me. I didn't even figure that much out.
In Primer. So it's a confusing film, definitely. Shane Carruth is not pandering to anybody with the screenplay here. He's just going to expect you to kind of catch up. There's a reason why there are a myriad of websites and different articles online you can find that try to break down exactly all the different timelines here. But what happens is they discover, those two characters, they end up discovering this time travel process and getting more and more caught up in it to the point where they leave out their other partners. And then we see this interesting battle, if you will, go on between them, where they're going back in time surreptitiously and their friendship starts to change, even though it just starts as a way for them to go back and make some money by betting on the stock market. Their dynamic changes as friends. And I think that's what really is so interesting for me, is that it's about their friendship. It's about the human cost of the decisions they make because of this accidental discovery. It's a film I've definitely been meaning to go back and rewatch for a long time. And maybe what I'll do, Josh, is have a Primer Upstream Color double feature.
Oh, don't do
and
that.
Just have my head
don't
explode.
Don't do that. No.
That'll be the end of Film Spotting. Yes. There will not be another show because I won't come back from it.
I'm not cleaning up that mess. I will allow the double pick, but if you had to choose between Aaron and Abe, which way would you go?
Man.
You remember how it ends,
I
right?
I do, actually,
right.
But I don't remember which character is which, so
okay.
I could throw out any name at this point.
Yeah, all right, that's fine. My number two comes from Godzilla. It's easy to forget that there are even people in this 1954 sci-fi
classic.
Okay,
you're not going Matthew Broderick.
No.
Thank you.
No, not that Godzilla. The original. There are people in it. There's also a fairly compelling human drama at work here. It's a love story. It's between Amiko, the daughter of a famous scientist, Daisuke Serizawa, who's the scientist's younger colleague, and then Ogata, who's a salvage ship captain. It takes the cooperation of all three of these to defeat Godzilla, and they do this by employing the invention of Serizawa's. It's the oxygen destroyer, which basically asphyxiates Godzilla underwater. Are you still with me, Adam? I know
Not
you love this
at
stuff.
All. I thought this was a big beast that just breathed like atomic fire out of its mouth.
So much more going on there.
Okay.
Well, I'm going with Serizawa, the genius scientist, as my pick. He's played by Akihiko Hirata, and he brings a real air of tragedy to this film. He really does. It's not only because it's clear from the beginning he's going to lose out in the romantic triangle. You can see that coming. But he's also, as we've touched on in a couple of these picks, one of these tortured scientists who realizes that his invention is going to be used for death and destruction. And at the end of the film, I'm going to give a Godzilla spoiler here.
Okay.
At the end of the film, he even sacrifices himself so that the oxygen destroyer can't be used again. This is pretty interesting for a movie that works really as a parallel for the creation and the employment of the atomic bomb.
Right. When was the last time you saw Godzilla?
There was a restoration, I want to say within the last maybe 5 years, certainly within the last 10 years.
I asked because I realized as you were talking about it that I think it's one of those films for me, like so many, that I feel like I've seen because I've seen so many scenes from it. It was
on
always
TV,
on TV,
yes,
it was
yeah.
on late at night.
And so many versions of it too.
And so many versions, and I would get caught up in it and watch it, but I don't know that I've ever sat down and seen it all the way through. I have no recollection of the character you're describing.
Right. Well,
no,
that's what
it's
happens.
Been that long.
Godzilla itself is a little overpowering. It tends to dominate your memory.
Just a bit. My number two pick for movie genius is another serious one. We're going with Max Cohen from Pi, the debut film from Darren Aronofsky. He's a number theorist. Like Aaron and Abe, he gets caught up a little bit in the stock market. He actually is using calculations on his computer to make stock picks. And one day the computer crashes and it spits out a number that's 216 digits long, but also makes a stock pick, and something crazy happens. It turns out that the stock pick was correct, but then he ends up going down this obsessive rabbit hole trying to make sense of that 216-digit number. And it's a really unnerving film, like you'd expect from Darren Aronofsky, having seen more of his work, of course, as that character Max becomes more and more obsessed. And I think, like Primer, again, it's a movie where you're not always sure which end is up, but it's a fascinating ride. Especially, I think the key thing here, Josh, for me, is especially as the math starts to collide with religion. Math, when you think about it, it's about answers. It's related directly to science, which is often at odds with religion. I mean, you think about numbers, they define a lot about our world, but they don't necessarily get at the larger existential questions. But what you see in Pi is maybe there is a relationship between math and science and religion. Maybe those numbers actually can give us some of the answers to these big questions. Why are we here? What happens to us when we die? When you consider that relationship, you can start to see why someone like Max, someone with that gifted of a brain, might become as obsessed as he does to the detriment of his livelihood and to his sanity.
The numbers are interrelated. Like, take the Hebrew word for father. Av, Aleph, Bet. 1, 2 = 3. All right? Hebrew word for mother, Aim, Aleph, Mem, 1, 40 = 41. Sum of 3 and 41, 44. All right? Now, Hebrew word for child, all right? Mother, father, child, yelad. That's 10, 30, and 4, 44. Torah is just a long string of numbers. Some say that it's a code sent to us from God.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's just kid stuff. Check this out, okay?
I'm all on board with that pick. Pi was probably going to be my number 6. My number one, though, is Dr. Mabuse the Gambler, a Fritz Lang film from 1922. It doesn't really attain masterpiece status. M. Metropolis are usually given that honor, but it's a really compelling film on its own. If you have more than 4 hours to spare, though, it was originally 2 pictures, and now, as you see it, it's broken into a bunch of different chapters, but does run a long time. The most fascinating thing is that the main character is not a hero, but the maniacal evil genius of the title. And I watched this on Fandor, actually, sponsor of Massacre Theater, and I really like their plot description they have on their website. The plot revolves around the pursuit of archfiend Dr. Mabuse, a gambler, hypnotist, master of disguises, and all-around criminal mastermind. Mabuse was the prototype for the sort of evil genius supervillains that would later become common in movies, whether it be in the James Bond pictures or in comic book adaptations like Superman and Batman. And I know we've talked, Adam, about Metropolis being such a precursor for so many films that we're still getting today. Mm-hmm. And I think Dr. Mabuse does work in that way as well. The first act is pretty amazing. It's this elaborately staged stock market manipulation scheme, and it does give you the sense that Mabuse uses his intellect to control the entire city,
wow,
not just play out these little small-time schemes. He does also have hypnotism to help him, and Rudolf Kleinroge, who plays Rotwang in Lang's Metropolis, he has what might be the original evil stare. You just really got to see this guy's eyes. I guess Lang must have been obsessed with this character because he later made The Testament of Dr. Mabuse in 1933 and then A Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse in 1960. And maybe next time I have 4 hours with nothing to do, I'll try to track those down.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating pick, a movie I'm not familiar with at all, but you sold me on it for sure. My number one movie genius is from a movie that I'm guessing a lot more of our listeners have seen, and it's been talked about a fair amount on the show back in 2010 and at the end of that year because it was a celebrated movie from that year. It's The Social Network. Mark Zuckerberg is my number one movie genius, and all I can really say about that character and why it fit into my top five so well is it's another example of a character with an advanced intellect, but it ends up being a film about the human cost, I think, of that intelligence and the fact that he's overly ambitious to the point where all he really cares about is advancing that intellect, accomplishing something great, pulling off something that no one's ever done before. And he cares a lot about the status that comes with that, but not at all really about those interpersonal relationships. And we see how those relationships crumble throughout the film. And I really like Eisenberg's performance. It was one of my favorite of that year because I don't think he goes out of his way at all to try to make Mark Zuckerberg likable, but he still ends up being somewhat endearing. And I think it's because he embraces the fact that he's a total contradiction. He's a character who always seems like he knows the angle. He's always in control, and no one's ever going to get the best of him. And he seems supremely confident, while at the same time, you know that he's the most insecure person in the room. And you see that in Eisenberg's performance.
In the 16th email, you raised concerns about the site's functionality. Were you leading them on for 6 weeks?
No.
Then why didn't you raise any of these concerns before?
It's raining.
I'm sorry?
It just started raining.
Mr. Zuckerberg, do I have your full attention?
No.
Do you think I deserve it?
What?
Do you think I deserve your full attention?
I had to swear an oath before we began this deposition, and I don't want to perjure myself, so I have a legal obligation to say no.
Okay, no. You don't think I deserve your attention?
I think if your clients want to sit on my shoulders and call themselves tall, they have a right to give it a try. But there's no requirement that I enjoy sitting here listening to people lie. You have part of my attention. You have the minimum amount.
There's just that Machiavellian quality to this genius in this case. He's not evil, but he doesn't always use his powers.
Well, it depends on how you feel about Facebook,
Adam. Yeah, exactly. You could probably see him that way. Some of the characters in the film see him that way, but I think he's complex. At least the character we see is complex. I don't know anything about, really, the real Mark Zuckerberg, and I don't care. I'm really fascinated by, though, the character that we see on screen that Aaron Sorkin and David Fincher and Jesse Eisenberg give us. So Mark Zuckerberg is my number one movie genius, and those are our top five movie geniuses. What about any honorable mentions, Josh?
Yeah, I had a couple of yours as honorable mentions, Real Genius and The Primer Duo. I also considered any iteration of Dr. Frankenstein, really, including his great-grandson, Gene Wilder's young Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Also, I thought about Good Will Hunting, which is another middlebrow prestige pick that's actually, I think, better.
You. Yeah,
better.
It's a good movie.
That's what I was going to say.
It's a really good movie.
Than what its reputation suggests. I thought about Piano Players as well. I was going to go that direction, so Shine and Amadeus were given some consideration. And then, lastly, a little bit closer to the ones we ended up going with, Dr. Manhattan of The Watchmen.
Yeah, I thought about Dr. Manhattan, too. Didn't make my honorable mention cut, even though I'm not a fan of that movie, and you are. That character's really interesting. Somehow it didn't quite fit for me where
he's too blue.
He's too blue and too naked and too large. But no, really, it just seemed more about the fact that he's not human. I mean, he's just not human. It seems
Well, he starts out human.
Yeah, he does, but somehow it just didn't quite fit for me. Maybe it's because I'm not a big fan of that film. But yes, I did consider The Royal Tenenbaums. Will Hunting, definitely in the running for me, probably my number six, because I love that movie, Good Will Hunting, and I especially think that Gus Van Sant does bring elements to that that only Van Sant would bring. One I left out, partly because this movie has come up a fair amount over the years and seems kind of like a boring pick, is Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
I think he certainly qualifies. Lex Luthor, Superman. I know Superman doesn't do anything for you, but one of the first movies I, as a kid, fell in love with was that original Richard Donner Superman in 1980-81. So,
and Gene
Lex
Hackman
Luthor,
is,
come on.
Yeah,
Hackman
he's
is
really good.
Pretty great. And finally, having just recently watched Jurassic Park, and even though I came away being less enamored with it than I was when I saw it in high school.
Because you scarred your children.
I did scar and traumatize my kids in the process. Dr. Ian Malcolm, Jeff Goldblum's character from Jurassic Park, he's not a main character in it, really, so I couldn't give him full consideration. In fact, looking back on the part, save for that great speech he has, that great dialogue he has with Richard Attenborough about the universe and how chaos will always win out and nature will always win out, I was thinking, what sold him on that script beyond the paycheck? Because he spends most of the film incapacitated. Like, Jeff Goldblum's role is him sitting on a table.
Easy money.
That's all he does.
Easy money.
That film. But I still considered him because he's a rock star mathematician. Apparently I'm
inspired
attracted to
by
that.
Buckaroo Banzai,
there you
perhaps.
Go. And going back to that film, which he was a part of. So those are our honorable mentions, and we'd love to get your picks for your favorite movie geniuses or any other comments about the show. Just email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release this week, opening here in Chicago, In the House, from the director of Swimming Pool and Eight Women. Also, Love is All You Need, directed by Denmark's Suzanne Beer. She's the filmmaker who brought us The Original Brothers and also After the Wedding, a film I'm a very big fan of. It's a movie about a woman who travels to Italy to recover from cancer and also is dealing with her husband's infidelity. And also very excited about this, Josh, opening here this weekend, Something in the Air. This is the latest film from Olivier Assayas, the director behind Carlos and Summer Hours and also Irma Vep.
You've seen that, right?
A coming-of-age story, that's right, that follows a young student who seems to be very active politically but is discovering his artistic side. It's autobiographical for Assayas. It takes place in the wake of the May 1968 student protests in France. And yes, it is in fact a film I saw at the Chicago Film Festival, a film I heartily recommend. And I know you've got a DVD copy of it in your possession. I'm hoping that maybe next week on the show we can spend a couple minutes on it if you're able to get to it.
I'll do my best.
That is my pick for the one movie to see opening this weekend, though we do need to acknowledge that in wide release, The Great Gatsby is opening from director Baz Luhrmann, Leo DiCaprio, Joel Edgerton, Tobey Maguire, and Carey Mulligan in that. Have you seen Gatsby yet, Josh?
I've seen Gatsby.
Okay, you have. So a little bit of a trick question. What's your one movie to see this weekend? I'm going Something in the Air. Where are you going?
I'm going to set Gatsby aside. We'll get to that later.
Okay.
I'm going to go with In the House, I think, because Azan's been an interesting director to me in addition to the films you mentioned. I've seen Potiche, which he made, which was pretty enjoyable. So yeah, that would be my pick, In the House.
We are going to discuss The Great Gatsby next week on the show so you can hear how Josh responded to it. I'm going to see it this weekend as well, of course. And we're going to share our top five movies about the rich. Seems like a perfect tie-in.
I love it.
Okay.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week was from Air Review. Learn more at airreview.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. Are you going to say that if I'm Kempinar?
Yeah. I'm going to share. So when he has to talk, I'll get him a little bit closer to me. Okay. You ready, Dave-O?
Yeah.
You ready, Adam?
I am.
Okay, let's make sure we're actually recording. Okay. From St. Paul, Minnesota, this is The Conversation with Daddy Van Halgren, with my guest, as always.
Daddy Van Halgren.
And a very special guest.
Adam Kempinar.
Thrilled to have you here, Adam, all the way up from Chicago. Very exciting. Well, today on The Conversation, the subject is...
Singing in the Rain.
Singing in the Rain. First off, just right off the top, what do you think?
Great.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you like about it, Dave?
because it's like, it's not too long, but a lot of songs.
Mm-hmm, a lot of songs. Do you like the songs?
Yeah.
What are some of your favorites?
I just, like, don't have a favorite because, like, especially my favorites because, like, like, brilliant because that's why it's one of the best musicals.
Right. Now, when we listen to the CD, though, there is one in particular that you do like to listen to.
You Were Meant for Me.
You Were Meant for Me. So, quickly, if you're not familiar with Singing in the Rain, you got Don Lockwood and Lena Lamont are these huge stars in the silent movie era, right? All of a sudden, there's a new movie, The Jazz Singer. There's talking in a movie, and suddenly that's all audiences want. They want talking movies, right? Mm-hmm. Gene Kelly, and, well, why is it hard for them to make a talking movie? What is it about Lena Lamont that...
She had the baddest voice in, like, that movie.
Oh, boy. What's her voice sound like?
Well, another part that I want to talk about, there's this movie, but the director told Lena Lamont when making a microphone, but she talks in the wrong spot in the microphone.
Can you believe it? It's just like they put the microphone in the flowers. They put the microphone, like, on her dress, and she just can't talk in the right place.
Yeah.
Oh, she's terrible. All right, let's get down to business. Stars.
I'll get it.
You want to think about it? I'll ask Adam first.
I say 70.
70 stars for Dave.
78, probably.
78 stars.
I say, like, more than you can count to. It's, like, so good.
So is Singing in the Rain more than 500 stars?
Yeah.
More than 500?
More than 600.
Wow, like 1,000?
Yeah.
1,000 stars. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying Singing in the Rain is a 1,000-star movie?
Yeah.
Adam?
Well, I'd like to understand Dave's system.
Okay, let's start there. So what does stars mean?
Like, you want to watch it that much.
You want to watch it that many times?
Yeah.
So a 500-star movie is a movie you'd want to watch 500 times, right?
Yeah.
And a 1,000-star movie is a movie you'd want to watch...
1,000
times. So... Adam, based on that rating, I know this will complicate your very intricate rating system. If you were on let's say 1,000-star scale, how many stars would you give Singing in the Rain?
Well, I was going to be very sneaky and clever, and I was going to say that I was going to give Singing in the Rain 365 stars because I could watch it every day of the year.
I think I'd give you the same value.
And that works, doesn't it? But instead, if we're going on the 1,000-star Dave Van Halgren scale, I'm going to go 950.
Anything else you want to say about the movie? We've got to eat dinner.
I don't think I can talk about it so good.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being here. This is The Conversation with Daddy Van Halgren. My guest, as always,
Dave Van Halgren.
And my special guest today with The Conversation, Adam Kempner. Thanks for being here.
Guys, it was an absolute thrill. Thanks so much for having me on, Dave.
Thanks.